Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to convey deep truths about life in places most Americans will never visit? My guest today has been traveling the world for more than 30 years, seeking out scenes that somehow capture far more than just the moment they depict. Perhaps his best-known work is the iconic 1985 National Geographic cover image of a green-eyed Afghan girl, but his body of work includes a vast array of equally stirring images. Steve McCurry is in town to speak about his work tonight at the Laura Rathy Fine Art in Dallas, where an exhibition of his solo work is on view until June 22nd. Steve, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you grew up in Pennsylvania.
Exactly.
Did you just long to travel from an early age?
Yeah, I didn't really even, I wasn't even aware of the outside world until I think I was 18 or 19. I used to play with my friends and we used to play sports. But there was a turning point when I worked in a company that had international division. And there were all these executives that came in from all over the world, Turkey and Ghana and Bolivia. And I suddenly start to realize there's this great big world out there and I want to see it. So I went to Europe and lived in Europe for a year, worked odd jobs. And after that, I was completely hooked. I decided, you know, whatever I do with my life, I want travel to be a part of it. So I set about looking for a purpose, something I could do that would allow me to travel. Went back to school, went to college, and about 3 years into college, I decided I want to be a filmmaker. I want to make movies. and part of my program was studying theater, acting, set design, and photography. Well, I took a fine art photography class, and I decided now I've really found what, you know, I have a real passion for making pictures. It was much easier. It was much more simple than film because I could literally walk out my front door with my simple little camera and work and make interesting pictures. And it was an individual effort. It was something that I could do anytime, anywhere, unscripted. Whereas a film was, you know, a big crew and you had a cameraman and a sound man and there was all this apparatus and equipment, and I thought, you know, this is what I can do, which is going to allow me to travel. And I thought, you know, magazine like National Geographic would be the perfect vehicle that would allow me to. So, you know that old expression, be careful what you wish for. I find myself, you know, looking back over more than 30 years, and I've literally been doing back-to-back assignments, you know, all over the world for magazines like National Geographic and Time and other magazines.
So what does it take when you get to a new place, sometimes with a tight deadline, sometimes with a little bit of time to spare, to feel like you understand it to the extent that you have, I don't know if right is the right word, but you have the right to even to begin trying to capture what exists there?
Well, I always feel like I need to understand a place and I need to feel comfortable. I need to know what the parameters are, what I can do, what I can't do. If I'm in a Muslim country, obviously can't photograph women on the street. There's other places, neighborhoods, if you're in Rio, there's neighborhoods, favelas that you simply can't go if you want to, you know, live and keep your equipment. So I want to find out, you know, what I can do, what I can't do. Do I need to be with an assistant? Do I need to be with a guide? Can I work at night? Where are the targets of opportunity? Where are the pools of the great areas? In a place like, say, Rio, which I just did a big project for the Pirelli calendar last year, there's some incredible neighborhoods with all kinds of life teeming about, with graffiti and people dancing in the streets. And but there's, you know, you have to be careful. So I like to go into a country or a city or a region and spend the first few days trying to understand what makes this place tick. What's visually interesting, and then I kind of ease into it and start to shoot.
And I guess I would imagine a lot of that exploration is best done on foot rather than sort of in the back of a cab.
Well, I'm a very impatient person, and I love to walking is certainly the best because you get to meet people and you really get to have a sense of the streets. I do like to – driving around does give you a quick overview of a city or a village or whatever. So I like to kind of get the quick overview and then get on the street, walk around, meet people, talk to people, joke and just try and, again, feel comfortable and feel – kind of, there's always this sort of them and us. You know, I'm this kind of Western American photographer, this white guy, and the people they're out there on the street could be Brazilian or Indian or Afghan or whatever. And I want to get to the place where I feel comfortable with them and I want them to feel comfortable with me. And then I feel like I'm inside the situation, inside the place, and there's not this separation between them and me.
I didn't expect you to tell me you were an impatient person because so much, as I understand it, of great photography is about sort of waiting for the right moment to emerge if you're doing documentary work.
Well, I can be patient. Sometimes almost like a hunter where you're kind of stalking your prey. You need to it needs time. And sometimes you see a situation unfolding and you see the prize, you know, at the end of the road. And you just, you know, if I wait long enough and sometimes, you know, you wait and there's no guarantee just by virtue of waiting, things are going to, develop and materialize. And so sometimes I just give up and walk away. But, you know, it depends.
So we'll talk about the photograph of the Afghan girl, who has a name, by the way, Sharbat Gula. But we'll talk about her in a minute. But I want to say your portraits of children are fascinating to me. And I was trying to figure out why, besides the fact that they are beautiful and piercing. And I think it's because in your work, you invite us to consider not just that moment in time, but also what's come before and what will come after for that child in a way that, like pictures of most kids in the United States, it's the opposite. They beg you to sort of dwell on that one moment of innocence and imagine that nothing else is ever going to happen.
Well, children, you have to work really fast with children. They are initially they're curious, they're fascinated with you, with the camera, and they give you that attention lasts for, you know, just a matter of sometimes seconds, 15 seconds, maybe. And then you've lost them. Mm-hmm. Once they wander off, finished.
Right.
Nothing in the world will get them back. So you have to work with that window, that very kind of small window. There's a sense of, in their eyes, a sense of amazement and wonder of you with this camera and this whole thing with your, and I always find that humor is a great way to break the ice and to have, because if people laugh and they, you know, people, we all love to laugh. The people who make us laugh, we like those people. And you want, if people like you and you humor them, they're willing to give you, you know, time. And they're also, often I find humor, if it's directed at yourself, then they really appreciate that if you're making, you know, if you're joking about yourself. And with children, but after a while, a child, they'd lose the attention. And then, but I love that innocence. And I love children who, you know, they're so kind of these young little people that are so kind of, you know, seeing everything, seeing the camera for the first time and having their, possibly their portrait taken for the first time.
Now that you are shooting, do you shoot on digital now?
Yes.
Yeah. So are kids the world over the same way they are in this country, where they really want to see the image that you've just taken on the monitor in your camera?
Yeah. That's everybody wants to see their picture. I'm reluctant to do that because it kind of shuts down the shoot. I mean, once people start looking at the camera, then everybody comes around, and then pretty soon the whole event has to do with looking at the back of the camera. So mm-hmm. I try to keep that to a minimum, although it's a great way to have people understand what you're doing. And once they look at their picture, they think, wow, that's amazing. It looks so good. And they're so pleased that that buys you extra time on the shoot.
Mm-hmm.
That'll give you another minute or two.
A lot of photographers who really admire your work are astonished at the very small size of your kit. And I understand that simplicity is something that you really, it's almost a philosophy in your work. Can you talk about the pros and cons of taking a lot of equipment versus not much equipment?
You know, I come from the school of, you know, Henri Cartier-Bresson and Robert Capa and André Kertész. They would go out with one Leica with maybe two lenses. I go out in the morning, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock, and I come back for lunch, but I'm out working all day. And I think when you're on the street, you need to be comfortable, you need to be relaxed, you need to be feeling good. And if you're encumbered with equipment, then you get tired, you end up, you know, sitting down when you should be walking around. Photography is very much of a performing art. You need to be able to move and be agile to, you know, get up on things and to be able to kneel down. And you have to be, it's almost like a ballet. You need to be able to move quickly and be very agile. So, I use one lens and one camera body. And everything I do an entire assignments. If I do all my assignments on that one lens, and if I can't do it with that one lens, then I don't do it. That's, yeah.
Are there times when you have found an ideal location and you're just waiting for someone to come along to animate that scene?
That's an old device and an old technique. There's a mural on a wall, there's a piece of graffiti, or there's some design where you know that if a person walks through the picture, they'll complete that design or that shape will give scale to the picture. So, again, Henri Cartier-Bresson was a master of seeing, pre-visualizing a situation and then waiting for somebody to walk into the picture to complete the design.
But then at that point, if it's just a stranger walking by, you have no ability, right? It's you catch it or you don't.
Yeah, well, exactly. But the satisfaction and the joy of capturing and having that person complete the composition—it's the pleasure of that, and the joy is fulfills your whole kind of purpose in your photography.
Does it change things for you now that you can go back to your room at the end of the day and you can see instantly, you know, pull up on your computer and see a pretty large format version of what you've shot instead of waiting so you get into a dark room?
Absolutely. You can never underestimate the being able to evaluate the focus,
mm-hmm.
the composition, the moment. You know, did I capture that moment? In the old days with film, you never quite knew. I got the portrait. Everything seemed to be right, but did the person blink? I can't remember if you know. But now with digital, you can evaluate all these things, and you can monitor if your camera equipment's working. In the old days, a lens could be faulty, and you would never know until you got home a month later and you found out that it was...
What a heartbreak. Goodness. Yeah. My guest is photojournalist Steve McCurry. He's in town to speak about his work tonight at Laura Rathy Fine Art in Dallas, where an exhibition of his solo work is on view until June 22nd. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with photojournalist Steve McCurry. He's in town to speak about his work tonight at Laura Rathy Fine Art in Dallas, where an exhibition of his solo work is on view until June 22nd. He also has a book out called The Unguarded Moment, which is the title of the show as well. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So let's talk about the picture of the Afghan girl that everyone knows. And I don't, perhaps you've grown tired of talking about this, but there is, it's an astonishing photograph when we look at it for so many reasons. And then you actually went back to find out what she was doing 17 years later. Yeah. It has to have been heartbreaking to see her and how she'd changed in so little time.
Actually, I was thrilled to find out that she was still alive. Yeah. We had gotten so many reports that she had been killed and she had died in childbirth. So when we found out, I mean, I never in a million years believed we could actually find her. And when a man walked into the room and said, the Afghan girl is my sister, we were completely thrilled. It was like a complete miracle. To be able to, and then to know that now we can actually help her and do something good for her. Her picture had been used hundreds of different ways and millions, been reproduced millions of times. And to be able to, you know, compensate her, to, you know, to pay her back, to try and make her life better was, we were just so happy to be able to do that. And we set about, you know, her big dream was to have education for her children, mm-hmm. and she also wanted to perform a Hajj, you know, the pilgrimage to Mecca.
Yeah.
So we were able to National Geographic provided that for her, and we keep in touch with her every month since we were reunited with her.
I read that you said that when you first took the picture, you didn't know necessarily that it was going to be anything different from the work that you were doing throughout the rest of that day.
Well, I knew as soon as I saw her that she was had an incredible look, beautiful set of eyes. And of all the students in that classroom, I thought, you know, I have to find a way to photograph her. So I set up a situation where I photographed many of the other girls in order to show her and to demonstrate to her that this was okay, there wasn't a, you know, it wasn't going to be a, you know, harm her in any way. She'd never been photographed. This was the first time in her life she was photographed. And so I came around to her, and at first she was a bit shy. She wanted to cover her face, and the teacher said, you know what, you know, we've been driven out of our country. It's important for the world to know what's happening. This photographer here is trying to tell our story, and we should help get our story out to the world. So then she basically lowered her veil, and I spent maybe half a minute, maybe 1 minute, photographing her. And again, she was curious. She was, you know, wondering, you know, who is this guy, this funny-looking guy with the camera? And
what does he want from me?
He doesn't want from me. And what's that, you know, he speaks a funny language and he's dressed in a other different kind of way. And so she kind of, I think part of her expression in the photograph is partly just curiosity of, you know, what is this guy doing? And then after a minute or whatever, she lost interest, and I mean, she just got up and walked away. She thought, well, that was fun.
I mean, there's an extraordinary power, and yet there are some limitations, I guess, you have to be aware of when a photograph can become synecdoche, really, for an entire life, an entire culture, an entire country. What do you have to think about as a photographer when you recognize that outside audiences may take this one image to stand for so much more than the image itself?
Well, inevitably, a photograph comes, you know, one or two or a few photographs come to symbolize an era. Or, you know, you think of World War II and you think of Iwo Jima, You think of the kiss in Times Square. There's a couple of pictures that become, or Vietnam with the little girl, the napalm victim running on the street, or Eddie Adams' picture of the execution in on the street. I think the Afghan girl in some ways became a symbol of that period of Afghan history. She came in a way to represent Afghan refugees and Afghanistan itself. And I think she has her faith. There's a certain dignity, fortitude, resilience in her expression. She's looking directly at the camera. She's proud. There's a sense of pride. And I think that a couple times I've gotten into the cab, into a taxi with an Afghan driver, and we've started to talk. And once they've realized that I'm the guy who took that photograph, at the end of the trip they say, "No, I don't want any money," and they're so happy, because I think that they're proud that that picture has become ingrained in people's memory or in their mind, people's mind all over the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Mike on the line in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hi. I'd like, Steve, to go over the issue of getting signed releases and permissions in the USA, and especially the difference outside the USA, in like some of those third world countries he goes to. And then if you would quickly just go over what he shoots with. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, as far as model releases and permissions, I've never done that, unless it's an advertising assignment or a corporate assignment, which then is required by the client. But in my own personal photography, I think it really gets in the way of the flow of my work to have a kind of a chance encounter on the street, and then to have somebody, you know, get a release out saying I can use the picture, or there's some kind of permission granted. If there's children playing on the street, I can't stop and explain. So as a result, the usage of my pictures is limited in the marketplace because I do not have. However, in the United States, and for editorial purposes, you don't require a model release. If it's for advertising, then you do. In terms of books, you're always, my personal books, there's always a possibility that somebody's going to sue you for that. But I think that, and that's a risk. I mean, you can always be sued or whatever by any time, by anybody, anytime, anywhere. But I think you just have to, I think I've always treated people with dignity and respect. I think if there was some kind of a court case, I think that my track record is that I've never met, you know. It's nothing that I've ever. Now, I work overseas. Possibly I worked in this country. It might be a different story because people are so, conscious about picture usage. So, but most of my work is in Asia and different other places.
Mike has a question about what you shoot.
Well, I use a 35mm camera. I've used a variety of different kinds of 35mm. I also use a large format Hasselblad. I use my lens is a 24-120 lens. When I go out to shoot, and of course I'll take two bodies in case one breaks, but I'm actually working on the street. I just have the one camera and the one lens. And I almost look like a tourist. I don't wear. I try and just keep it very simple. I almost never use a flash, and rarely use a tripod. So it's everything I do is with that one camera and that one lens.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. To what extent does your status as a foreigner affect the way your subjects see you and respond to you and therefore respond to your camera and your attempt to take their pictures?
I think the world at this point, it's there's so many tourists, so many travelers going to every nook and cranny of the planet that if you go into the smallest village in India or China or Africa or South America, that they've seen me before and they see us as tourists with a camera. And I never explain that I'm working for a magazine or whatever. I just walk around and take pictures. And I think people now are very familiar with literally you go into the most remotest parts of the world and they're very familiar with cell phone pictures and everything. So it's that's just the way the world is.
Do people all over the world, is their first instinct to smile for the camera?
In some place, generally, yes. And I try and get past that. I mean, usually people are a little bit self-conscious. They're a little bit nervous. They're trying to put on a particular kind of look or face. And I kind of try and work through that so that they're more natural, more relaxed, and it becomes more more authentic about who they are as a person and without all that artificial stuff going on with their. So, but some places they're, you know, they're not really that familiar with the camera or the fact that people generally say, you know, say cheese or whatever. So, yeah, no, I prefer that actually to people grinning.
Yeah, you want to get to that unguarded moment.
Right, exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah.
How does that work when you don't speak the local language and you're not necessarily working with an interpreter?
You always have to have I think a photographer learns a lot about body language and how people, you know, the psychology of relationships. And as I said, I think if you can engage people with humor and come in with respect and deal with them as, you know, real people and you're on their level. And it's not that, you know, I'm the photographer and they're this quaint native or villager. But if you really relate to people as you're just equal human beings, a little bit of humor and but you have to have a genuine interest in people. And I think if you are, it's an, you know, they sense that. People, I think there's kind of an animalistic quality where they know that you're there and you're together and there's going to be this sort of cooperation. You're going to do this thing together, this portrait. And they partake. They you know, you get this relationship going. And but humor and respect, I think, are central to having people cooperate and be part of your process.
A lot of your best known work features people in places that, at least to American eyes, look quite poor. And have you found that sort of the most economically challenged people and places convey the heart of a culture better than, say, its middle class or its upper classes?
Oh, absolutely. I did a story for National Geographic some time ago on Sunset Boulevard in L.A. And for the first half of Sunset Boulevard, it's ethnic. It's you know, it's Chinese and it's Hispanic. And once it got into the gated community, forget it. You couldn't get in there. It was impossible. The people in villages around the world, they live their lives on the street. They're out there playing and eating and sleeping and whatnot. And you can really walk through the neighborhood or the village and see their life unfolding. Whereas in the richer neighborhoods, you don't see anybody because then they're home, they're behind fences and gates and all that. So I would take a neighborhood in Calcutta Rangoon or Rio where all this life, this energy is out on the street rather than some place like, not that I have anything against Scandinavia, but you're not going to find that those moments in Stockholm or mm-hmm. Oslo or Copenhagen or Helsinki. Everybody's things don't happen on the street. People have homes, and it's cold. You go to Bombay, and man, it's just crazy. Everything's happening everywhere all the time.
There's an image in the book that I really loved, and I think it's called Blue Courtyard, the Blue Courtyard. And it's basically just, I guess it's a shared common outdoor space, and there's somebody lying on a mat just kind of laughing with his friend, and there's a kid playing, and there's a woman, I don't know if she's doing wash, and it just feels exactly like what you have been describing. It feels like real life, and they all seem so comfortable with one another, even though they're all doing different things.
Well, there's a couple places, again, these places that you come familiar with that you make great pictures because of there's such one such place in India called Jodhpur where you have this kind of incredible architecture in the neighborhood that looks like something out of a movie set, and people dressed in a particular way, and all their activity, they're playing or sleeping or eating or washing or whatever they do, is right there in public view. So you can see their lives unfold in this setting, this backdrop of this incredible ancient architecture, and it's all painted blue. And it's like, it's just to die for. It's amazing. I never get to, I've been there 30 times, and I always go back again because I just love the place.
Do you have to, once you know a place well, do you have to work a little harder to notice things about it that are remarkable?
Yeah, you could say, well, you've been there and you keep looking at it and you feel like you've been there and done that. And you need to get yourself into a particular place in your mind where you're seeing things fresh and you're not thinking I've been here 25 times. It's always new and fresh and interesting. Yeah.
We're speaking this hour with photojournalist Steve McCurry, who is in town to speak about his work tonight at Laura Rathy Fine Art in Dallas. The gallery is holding an exhibition of his solo work through June 22nd. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we will be taking more of your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with photographer Steve McCurry. He's in town to speak about his work tonight at Laura Rathy Fine Art in Dallas, which will be hosting an exhibition of his solo work through June 22nd. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. And we have Anu on the line in Dallas. Hi, Anu.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Welcome.
My husband's an amateur photographer, and he's technologically a bit savvy. So what he does with his pictures is enhance them digitally. I'm not too familiar with the technologies he uses, but I know he enhances them digitally sometimes. And I've seen mixed reaction from people when he does that. Some of them are impressed. Some are they undermine the picture because it has been enhanced. I just want to find out what your guest thinks about such pictures, and if it is something that that's appreciated generally in the photography world or not, is something that I would like to get his opinion on.
Anna, when you say enhanced, do you mean like he's bumping up the colors and that sort of thing?
Right. But it doesn't change the mood of the picture. It doesn't change the subjects or anything of that sort. Just enhancing the colors or the things like that.
What do you think, Steve?
I think if you're doing photography for your own pleasure and you're photographing for artistic purposes, fine art photography, I think you can do anything. I think that whatever you can, I think the sky is the limit if you're doing documentary photography. If you're a photojournalist working for a magazine or a newspaper, there are very strict ethical guidelines about keeping the picture true to the scene or what you were photographing. You can't change the color beyond what it was as it really was in real life or move things around. So for me, in my photography, I want it to be realistic. I want it to reflect what it was that I saw when I was there. We all know since the beginning of photography that the skies tend to become too bright and you need to darken the skies. So that's a technical thing, and they've been doing that back for more than 100 years. So beyond that, you have to be very careful, especially if you're doing documentary photography, not to make it so kind of bizarre and garish and untrue to reality. It has to be real, I think.
I read that you prefer to shoot in cloudy conditions if you can.
Well, I think in color photography, I prefer a muted kind of low contrast, even kind of I don't like bright, I don't like shadow, too bright shadow. I don't like the contrast range to be too great between the shadow and the highlights. So also my eyes are very sensitive to bright light. I prefer if it's a cloudy day like today, this is great. I could work all day long. If it's sunny and bright, I generally spend the first 2 or 3 hours working outside. And then for maybe from 9 to 3 in the afternoon, I work inside. And then for the last 3 or 4 hours of the day, I'll go back out into the sun. I just don't like the look of color photography and bright light. It's just me. I mean, I'm sure there's other photographers that prefer bright light, but I'm not one of them.
Do you find that you're always thinking like a photographer and you're always sort of consciously or unconsciously framing up shots, or given the energy and the effort that it takes to do that well, is it something you distinctly turn on and off?
I think you're always looking at things in a photographic way, sometimes more than others. If I'm walking down the street to get a loaf of bread or some milk, my mind is somewhere else. And the great thing about photography, the great thing about street photography is that you know, everything else goes away, yesterday, tomorrow, what you're going to have for lunch. And you really get focused on the present, on the here and now, on sounds and cracks in the sidewalk and children playing. And to me, that's wonderful. It's almost like a meditation, I would say.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Richard on the line in Dallas. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Steve, it's an honor to speak with you as a fellow photojournalist who's lucky enough to get paid for photography full-time. Your work has always been inspiring, so please continue on. My question real quick is related to the last one. I was just curious if you actually do all of your post-processing now or if you farm that out to someone that you trust.
A good question. I don't do any work with the computer with my pictures at all. I have people in my studio who do all that. I work with them, and we'll interpret the picture. I'll explain what I want, and then they'll carry out my instructions. But as far as I think the main point is that there are technicians that can work on pictures that do this full time, and they're much more skilled than I could ever be. I mean, take a piano player who plays the piano 6 or 8 hours a day; they get very adept and very skillful. For me, I don't have the time or the energy or the to really get into all this post production. So I leave that to people who do it much better than I would.
Imagine that you go to the same location 3 days in a row, but of course each day all of us is in a slightly different mood. How does your mood affect the way you shoot, what you shoot, and ultimately what you produce?
Well, that's a good question about going back to the same place. I remember when I was at Angkor Wat, I went back to the same temple area somewhere between 25 and 30 times. Actually, the same view. It was almost the same picture. But I would go back in different times of the day, different light, different moods. There were different people. It's almost like a kaleidoscope. Every time you turn it slightly, there would be a new picture. So I went back every day over and over again, different seasons, dry season, rainy season, in the morning, in the afternoon, different activity, people harvesting. I think that's, to have that dogged persistence and to you raise the bar each time you go back and you want to do it better and you become dissatisfied with those early pictures because you know you can do better.
We have an email here from Ashley who wants to know, do you ever take printed images back to the people in your photographs? If so, I imagine it would be a prized possession for some of the people in small, poor villages.
I do print pictures now and then. I'll print up 20 or 30 pictures. It's a great way to show your appreciation for the people you've been working with. It also is a way to kind of reopen up the door again, to go back and give them something. They're happy, and it creates goodwill. Sometimes it's difficult because so much of the people I photograph are these chance encounters. You meet them on the road, or they're in a village, they're in a town, and they don't necessarily have an address or an email. But if possible, I'll try and do that.
There's a wonderful photograph. I think it was on your website, and I don't believe I saw it in the book, and I don't know if it's in this show, but it's of a little boy somewhere in Latin America, and he's got a toy gun to his head, and he's crying, and he just looks miserable. And you tell the story in the text. You say he'd been teased by some other kids. It's such a disturbing picture, even though it's a moment that's probably happened to everybody's kids in the world. What do you do with a photograph that is really great and evocative, but may or may not, on first glance, really tell the entire story? I mean, for all we know, he was dirty and poor, but for all we know, he's beloved at home and that sort of thing.
Well, the ambiguity of it, the mystery, and the question the picture raises, I think, are, you know, we've all been there. I remember when I was a child, there were some kids in the neighborhood who tried to strangle me. And I remember looking at these people, and they were like friends of mine, and I thought, I'm going to die, because the rope was getting tighter and tighter around my neck. And I thought, you know, this is not funny. This is, yeah. You know, I'm literally can't breathe. And I kind of thought about that when I was photographing this child. But it's one of these situations where, I walked over to the child. I made a couple of pictures. It's a toy gun. It's not a real gun. And it was clear that there were other children around. They had been playing, and this wasn't a grave, dark.
He wasn't in danger.
He wasn't in danger. Mm-hmm. And once I made a couple of pictures, I was with a Peruvian translator, and we tried to, you know, what's going on? You know, what's the problem? And this all happened in a matter of seconds, and then he basically ran off and went, because this was in front of his home. Mm-hmm. So it looks profoundly sad and disturbing. In fact, I think it wasn't that grave of a situation. Sometimes it's better not to know too much about the picture, because you find out the picture, well, that's not that interesting after you know the story, the backstory.
Mm-hmm. Is it your goal to always, I think one reason that I'm drawn to your photographs is that they leave me with a lot of questions, that I wonder how we got to this place and who these people are and what their lives are like and what their homes are like. Are you seeking to sort of put some unanswered questions into every picture?
I think one of the great things about photography and pictures is that you can look at it and you can come up with a story in your own mind, a fantasy, some kind of an idea to interpret the picture. And sometimes those stories and that interpretation is far more interesting than the actual picture in itself. And when I'm editing my work, and you've taken multiple pictures of the same situation, sometimes you want to choose a picture which does, raise questions and seems has a sense of ambiguity, which you kind of wonder, it makes it more mysterious.
I mean, I have to imagine, I know you're not there all that often, but I have to imagine the offices of National Geographic are a very exciting place to be for people doing work on the level that you are. When you're with your colleagues who are doing similar projects all over the world, maybe with a different approach, what do you guys talk about? Guys and gals, I should say.
Yeah, there's I would say there's some of the great photographers working today are women. And we get together in at National Geographic or Magnum Photos, my agency in New York. And we, you know, we'll talk. We've all been to Burma mm-hmm. or whatever, and we'll talk about, you know, Burma then, Burma now, and our experiences. We'll trade sort of war stories. We've often traveled to the same places and met each other at these places over the years. So we're all faced with the same troubles with, you know, magazine editors and trying to get assignments and all the things that go into would make up the freelance photography world. So it's great fun to trade all these stories.
What's the difference for you between a great day at work out in the field and a day that you just sort of go home and can't wait to turn it all off?
A great day is you get up in the morning and you get out and you feel you're in a groove. You feel you're really connecting. You're seeing pictures all over the place. And then you go back to the hotel or wherever you're staying and you have a nice lunch, you kind of clean your equipment. You go back out in the afternoon and a couple wonderful things happen and you feel, you know, great. On the other side, maybe you've asked for permission to get into a temple or a school or a hospital or some wherever you're working and you get to the place and that permission hasn't come through and you've wasted 2 or 3 hours and then you go someplace and it is either too sunny or it's raining or the weather's off. And then the driver that's supposed to take you around doesn't show up or your guide's sick or you've forgotten some you know, your memory card or something like that. And you're just not in sync. You're out of sync with the day and things aren't dovetailing. And then you go out in the afternoon, your mind is distracted. When my mind is disturbed, I can't work. If I'm upset about something, it's hard for me to get back into that zone, because for me, I need to be in a good mood. I need to be comfortable, and if I'm thrown off my game, it can be a problem.
Steve McCurry is a photojournalist and author and illustrator of the book The Unguarded Moment. A show, The Unguarded Moment, is on view at Laura Rathy Fine Art in Dallas through June 22nd. And Steve McCurry will be speaking there about his work tonight. Steve, thank you so much for being with us. It's been great.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. If you would like to make a comment, ask a question, or make a suggestion, you can email all that to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.